Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. The Big Beautiful Bill has passed Congress. However, it's missing a provision that was removed a few days before the final vote. This provision would have allowed the sale of millions of acres of public lands across the United States. The proposed sale generated bipartisan backlash. Despite being removed from the bill, Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah vows to continue pushing for the sale of this land. Joining me now to discuss the public land sell-off amendment that was almost a part of the Big Beautiful Bill is Maxine Josselow, a reporter for the New York Times. Maxine, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me.
Can you give us an overview of what this provision would have allowed that used to be in the Big Beautiful Bill when it comes to public lands?
Sure. So this provision from Senator Mike Lee would have allowed anyone, whether they're an individual or a corporation, to purchase public land from the federal government, specifically from the Bureau of Land Management. The total amount of acreage that was eligible to be sold was between 2.2 million and 3.3 million acres in Mr. Lee's original proposal. And that was then decreased or reduced to about 1.225 million of acres of public land in 11 Western states in Senator Lee's final proposal before it was stripped out of the bill.
So do we know why Senator Mike Lee of Utah decided to try to put this in to President Trump's trademark piece of legislation here, especially after the backlash? Maybe did he not check to see if other people liked it? Do we know where it came from?
Those are great questions. Senator Mike Lee has been a longstanding vocal advocate for selling public lands, and his main argument in more recent years has been that the West in particular has a very dire shortage of affordable housing and that these tracts of land could be bought up by developers and affordable housing could be built on these plots. And he seems to have not necessarily registered the degree of opposition to that idea in introducing this latest proposal, but that is the justification that he used, primarily housing.
Okay, we'll get into the bipartisan backlash he received in just a minute. But first, I wanted to just dig into the idea of defining public lands a little bit. Just to clarify, we're not talking about national parks, correct?
That's correct. So Senator Lee, in the language that he had inserted into what Republicans were calling their One Big Beautiful Bill Act, didn't clarify the exact tracts of land that would be eligible to be sold, but he did include the states and he did make public comments to the effect that we're not talking about selling off the rim of the Grand Canyon. We're talking about selling off discrete parcels that are near cities that lack affordable housing, places like Reno, Nevada, for example. So not national parks, national landmarks, but public lands owned by the Bureau of Land Management adjacent to population centers.
Yeah, so this idea of public land, so there's a department in the federal government called the Bureau of Land Management, and they manage these millions of acres of land where the idea is there's no development. It's set aside to be managed by the federal government. Can anything happen on this land, or is it just kind of there?
A lot could happen on this land, mostly for outdoor recreation, if you want to go hiking or biking on that land, or if you want to go hunting or fishing or camping on that land, you're welcome to do that. And I know we're going to get to some of the backlash soon, but a lot of the backlash was from hunters and anglers who were worried about the impact on the lands where they hunted and fished.
Okay, so we can talk about the backlash. So basically, Senator Lee put this in the bill, and some say maybe he put it in there because it was such a large bill that did he think maybe it would just slide through? Do you know what I mean? Like sometimes there's provisions in a very large bill and they can get in and very, very few people who actually read the whole entire thing notice. And so do you, is it possible that he thought maybe it would just slide on through?
You know, I wouldn't want to speculate about his motivations without talking to him directly or have him address that directly. But absolutely, I think in general, there's a longstanding history in Washington of lawmakers in both parties inserting perks for their home states or their pet priorities into massive pieces of legislation and maybe hoping that they won't get as much scrutiny. In this case, this was definitely noticed by many people and quickly got a lot of scrutiny. It's not like it flew under the radar for even a few days.
In some of the comments he did make regarding his provision in the legislation, which I think most of the comments he made were maybe on social media, he said that the federal government owns too much land and doesn't do a good job of managing it. So that was a part of his reasoning, at least that he told the public. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, that was certainly part of it. And I think the argument about affordable housing is a newer argument. Senator Lee has said for years and years that he thinks the government has too much land and that some of it should be turned over to states or the public. The affordable housing argument was a newer one that we saw him make just this year.
Yeah, so a part of the backlash that we mentioned is, you know, both Democrats basically stood up and said, we are not in favor of this. But then, surprisingly, a significant a few members of the Republican Party also stood up and said, we are not in favor of this. And at one point, the plan was revised due to this backlash where people were saying that they weren't going to vote for the bill. So the text was changed to say that the land would only be sold if it was within 5 miles of an area of major population. So this was him leaning more into that affordable housing thing, because I guess if you sold millions of acres of public land and then plop some housing out in the middle of nowhere, that might not be attractive, right? So this was like leaning in more toward populated areas.
That's right. And there were a couple of other changes that were made in response to some of the backlash by Senator Lee. That was one of them, that the land had to be within 5 miles of a population center. Another was the total acreage was slashed significantly to a little over 1 million acres from a little over 2 to 3 million acres. And then another change, and this is a little bit in the weeds, but the original proposal would have included land that's owned by the National Forest Service, the US Forest Service, including national forests. And he changed it so that only land owned by the Bureau of Land Management was eligible. And that's because he is chairman of the Senate Energy Committee, and he doesn't actually have jurisdiction over the Forest Service. That's the Senate Agriculture Committee. So he was, I think, hearing grumbles on the Hill about that too.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the potential of sale of public lands with Maxine Joselow, a reporter from the New York Times. So obviously, the Republican so-called Big Beautiful Bill passed by a narrow margin, and there were some Republicans from Western states who said that even after he narrowed down the provision and made it within 5 miles of the population, made it half the amount of land. There were some Republicans in Western states who said that they would not vote in favor of the whole bill if this land sale portion was still in there. One of your stories mentions a Republican from Montana who said that he agrees. He thinks the federal government has too much land, it's mismanaged, but this is not the solution. So talk to me more about this idea of some Republicans being so against this public land sale that they were willing to not vote for President Trump's bill.
Yeah, and you mentioned a Montana Republican. It wasn't just any Montana Republican. It was Representative Ryan Zinke, who actually led the Interior Department during Trump's first presidency. And the Interior Department is the parent agency of the Bureau of Land Management. So, yeah, Representative Zinke and a few other House Republicans called in a joint statement the land sell-off a quote-unquote poison pill that would cost their votes for the entire giant package. And I think they were hearing from their constituents in Montana and across the West where selling public lands does not poll well and is unpopular.
What do you think he means, Senator Lee means when he says, or even Representative Zinke, who was, both of them kind of said, like, they agree the government has too much land and it's mismanaged. What do you think they mean when they say mismanaging the land?
I again, I wouldn't want to speak
Yeah,
for them, but
I don't know. Does the federal government do a do they think they do a bad job of managing the land? I don't know what a bad job of managing land looks like.
I don't know. I don't want to speak for them. That being said, I think they have publicly criticized the Biden administration and Democratic administrations in general for a long time over their management of public lands and what they see as the over-prioritization of renewable energy development on public lands. So under President Biden, we saw the Bureau of Land Management in some ways become a key agency focused on addressing climate change by accelerating the permitting process for wind energy projects and solar energy projects on public lands. And I think a lot of conservative lawmakers pushed back and said these lands should be reserved for oil and gas and fossil fuel extraction and mining and livestock raising and not just green energy development.
What did you make of the idea that some of these key Republicans were kind of joining sides with Democrats and speaking out about against this provision? Does it just show that even in very polarizing times, things can reach across the aisle?
Yeah, I thought it was a really interesting political moment to observe and to capture in my reporting. And I even did a story not just on the Republican lawmakers who were speaking out and joining with Democrats and making somewhat of strange bedfellows, but also there were some MAGA influencers on social media who are outdoorsmen, they hunt, they fish on these lands, and they too were speaking out and urging their pretty large social media followings to call Senator Lee's office, call their elected representative, and tell them to oppose this provision.
Yeah, it was interesting to see that, someone with a lot of Instagram followers who normally is very pro things coming out of the Trump administration to make a call saying stop this part of the bill. That had to be interesting for Senator Lee. I know you don't want to speculate on what he was thinking, but that was probably a lot of talk about, a couple of sentences in a big giant bill.
Yeah, absolutely. And, one of the individuals, one of the MAGA influencers that I mentioned in that piece was this gentleman, Cameron Haynes, who is identifies as a Republican, voted for Trump, is very conservative and generally supports the president's agenda. But on this issue, he was posting to his millions of social media followers to oppose this provision and to keep, quote unquote, to keep public lands in public hands. And this is not a liberal tree hugger. This is someone who was at the White House recently meeting with RFK Jr., the Health and Human Services Secretary, someone with deep ties in Trump's orbit.
Now, I know you didn't get to talk to Senator Lee about this, but from his comments that he was making regarding this, I mean, he did pull it out from the bill, but he made it seem like he's still going to pursue this through other channels. Would you agree that he's going to still try to pursue this somehow?
I would agree. And yeah, just to clarify, I did obviously do my very best to reach out to
Yeah.
Senator Lee. I emailed his spokeswoman, texted, called, et cetera, looked for him on Capitol Hill. Did not get a response to that question and others, but that question is a valid one to be asking. And I do think there is an assumption here in Washington that this is not the last word. This is not the last fight over this plan. And Senator Lee feels very passionately about this issue and could try to resurrect this public land sell-off by tucking it into another must-pass piece of legislation, like, for example, the annual defense policy bill or an annual appropriations bill.
Do you know if just selling public land, does it have to be approved by Congress? Is that something that has to happen?
That's a good question. I believe so, but I don't want to mislead your listeners, and I would want to double check that.
Okay. Yeah. I was just wondering if it would, if it, because I don't, as we said, we don't know, you know, Senator Lee, if he's like a one-man band pushing this or if it's coming from other parts of the Trump administration too. I didn't know if an executive order to sell public land was possible or had happened. I don't know the history, so. Well,
Yeah, I wouldn't.
go
I'm
ahead.
sorry.
Yeah, do
I
you, yeah, you
just
don't
was
know the
gonna
hist
say.
yeah, you don't know the history either, yeah.
Yeah, and I wouldn't actually expect an executive order on that. I don't think it's something that Trump feels as strongly about as Senator Lee.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll have to just stay tuned to see where Senator Lee tucks his public land sale into the next bill. But I want to thank you so much for your time. That was New York Times reporter Maxine Josselow. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
And coming up, we're going to talk about government policies when it comes to impact on public land. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah had an amendment in the Trump administration's so-called Big Beautiful Bill that would have allowed for the sale of millions of acres of public land. Ultimately, this plan was removed from the final version of the bill after backlash from both sides of the aisle. However, that is not the only way the GOP is trying to expand commercial access to public lands. The Department of Agriculture announced recently they would be rescinding the roadless rule, which protects tens of millions of acres of national forests from development and construction, some of which are here in Ohio. Joining me now is Kate Gretzinger, Communications Manager for the Center for Western Priorities. Welcome to All Sides, Kate.
Thank you so much.
So I mentioned changes in what I said was called the so-called roadless rule. Can you tell me what this rule is and what it actually means for American forests?
Sure. So the roadless rule was put into place back in the early 2000s in response to clear cuts in logging that were really destroying our national forests, leading to, you know, greater flooding because the trees are gone, and then reduced water quality. So it was really put into place to protect mature and old growth forests that were still standing. And it protects over 58 million acres of national forest in the United States. So those protections will be going away. Essentially, the thought behind it is if you can't build roads into those areas, you can't log them. So by removing that ban on road building and road reconstruction, it will open up around 60 million acres to logging, and that includes clear cutting.
Okay, so the roadless rule is exactly what it says. You can't build a road in this area. So that's what they're taking away. They're allowing, do they have to allow the logging, or is it just allowing the roads, like, makes logging allowed? Does it also make logging
that's
allowed?
A great question. You know, they don't have to allow logging, but they're certainly going to. The Trump administration has issued a number of orders really pushing logging, and the Big Beautiful Bill that you mentioned includes provisions increasing logging as well. So it's just one piece in a larger puzzle that is selling out our public lands to the timber industry.
Okay, so the earlier in the hour, we spent time talking about this idea of one senator from Utah specifically wanting to sell public lands and be able to allow anyone to buy public lands. So is this kind of related in a different way, where it's saying that the federal government owns these lands, so we can do what we want with them. That is that how taking away the roadless rule and allowing logging is allowed because the federal government is the manager of the land?
That's right. Yeah. So the U.S. Forest Service is housed in the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and that is a federal agency that essentially takes its orders straight from the White House. So yeah, it's not the same as selling out the land to private owners. That's sort of a different issue. However, it is part of an all-out attack on our public lands that we're seeing, where they're really being viewed only for their extractive potential and their potential to make money for big corporations like oil and gas companies, timber companies. In the case of Mike Lee's attempt to sell the BLM's Forest Service lands for housing, that would have been developers profiting off these lands. It's really a part of a wholesale effort to take what is a public resource and sell it to the highest bidder that we're seeing going on across our public lands.
Now, you said that it was the Department of Agriculture that was removing the roadless rule. Does that apply to the Bureau of Land Management or in the Department of the Interior, or is that separate?
That's separate. The Bureau of Land Management doesn't have those lands. There are forests on those lands. However, the roadless rule only applied to national forest lands. So, but the Bureau of Land Management is also being required to step up timber production in thanks to the Big Beautiful Bill you mentioned earlier. It requires almost a doubling of the amount of timber logged per year on BLM lands. And while we're on it, that bill requires more than doubling the amount of timber production on Forest Service lands.
Okay, so this is interesting. So there's national forests, and then there's public lands, and then there's national parks. And these are all three different ways to designate a piece of land. Is that right?
I would say they're all public lands. Our national forests are public lands. They happen to be national forests. BLM lands, which is the Bureau of Land Management, that's just sort of the agency that manages like a lot of desert lands. We call those BLM lands and also public lands. And then our national parks, of course, are also public lands, but they have that special protection of being a park.
Do you know if removing the roadless rule could mean other development could happen in the forests, or is it just logging?
Yeah, that's a great question, one I haven't gotten before. It's definitely aimed at logging. However, when you build roads into forests, it increases recreational access, which of course can be a good thing. However, 85% of wildfires in the West are started by humans. So when you get more people farther into the forest, you get more fires. So, and you also get more fires from, trucks driving on roads. If there's a chain dragging, which of course happens when you're logging, it increases wildfire risk. So that's sort of an inadvertent in impact of removing this roadless rule.
You explained why the roadless rule exists, but do you know when it was put into place? Is this a long-standing thing?
Yeah, it was in the early 2000s, I believe 2001. It was under the Clinton administration. There was something called the Timber Wars that happened in the Pacific Northwest, where activists were, climbing up trees, sitting in trees, so that logging companies couldn't log them, and really rich history there. The roadless rule actually kind of came into play to protect the northern spotted owl. Which is an endangered species that lives in the Pacific Northwest. And this is sort of, so it's really wrapped up in protecting endangered species as well, because a lot of these animals live in these forests.
Is repealing the roadless rule, is it universal for all national forests, or is it piece by piece, state by state?
Yeah, it is for all national forests. However, two states, I believe Colorado and Idaho, have their own statewide roadless rules that will remain in place according to the Trump administration. That's as far as we know. Yeah.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the development of publicly owned lands with Kate Gretzinger, Communications Manager for the Center for Western Priorities. So are there groups out there particularly pushing to put the roadless rule back in? I'm trying to do some sort of rolled back in pun, but I don't know, it's not working.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Yes. There are a number of organizations that will be watching this and advocating against this repeal. However, because it's an agency level rule, it really is up to the Trump administration, and they do have the authority to repeal it. So there's not a lot of recourse here, I would say, due to how the rule was created.
So, since it's an agency level rule, it doesn't have to be approved or disapproved by Congress in any way.
That's right. Yeah.
But what we were talking about in the previous part of the show is that Congress is involved in this act of actually selling the public lands. Is that your understanding that Congress would have to say public land could be sold?
Yeah. So for large scale privatization of public lands, yes, Congress holds the power there. However, the agency can transfer smaller tracts of public land. Thanks to a bill passed in the 70s called the Federal Land Policy Management Act, FLPMA. And it gives the agency the discretion to transfer slash sell small tracts of public land, like under 1,500 acres, I believe, for housing if it meets criteria such as there's no higher use for that land. Like it's near its town, it's near a city, it's not, it doesn't have high recreational value. So that legislation, that law that we already have in place allows the BLM to transfer tracts of land in these specific cases where it really meets these criteria. So that was one thing we argued when Mike Lee, introduced this idea to sell off, 2 to 3 million acres of public land and make over 200 million acres eligible for sale. We said, no, we don't need this. The law already allows the federal government to sell this land, if it's the highest and best use for that land. So yeah, that's a little background on that.
Utah Senator Mike Lee, who wants to sell off public lands for development, he says the federal government has too much land. I don't know how much is too much. Do you know how much land the government has?
Yeah, so I don't know the Forest Service numbers, but the Bureau of Land Management manages around 245 million acres of public land. And that's really what Mike Lee is talking about when he's talking about Utah, at least, because the majority of the land, that public land in Utah, is Bureau of Land Management land. And I think it's around 65 to 70% of the land in Utah is owned by the federal government, which is a lot of land, but any of your listeners who have been to southern Utah have seen it's desert land, like in its canyon country. You can't build houses or cities in these canyons, and in this desert. There's not a lot of water. Drought is a huge issue here. It's just there's a reason this land isn't developed, and there's a reason it's been held in federal trust, and that's because its best and highest use is recreation, habitat, rangelands, things like that it's currently being used for.
Who decides when land becomes federal land?
Oh, so that's a great question. It really, most of it was decided back when the states entered, when they were territories and they became states. They signed contracts with the federal government that said, we're becoming a state. The federal government gave them a lot of land. So the territories were owned by the federal government. They became states, and the federal government said, you can keep this land in trust and you can sell it to fund public education. And the rest of it, the federal government is holding in trust for the citizens of the entire country. And that's really how that played out at statehood. And then there's been a ton of transfers and sales and purchases throughout the past, century and a half, whatever, however long Utah's been a state, and other states in the West that have sort of, moved land around. But the main lines were drawn back when the territories became states.
One example that Senator Lee gives is that there's public land really close to Reno, and he, I think that's a city. Anyway, but he was saying that that's where affordable housing is needed, and so you're saying that under provisions that already exist, the federal government could sell that to the state, right?
That's right. They could. Reno is a great example. That's in Nevada. St. George is in southern Utah. That's another one that's really been brought up a number of times. It is surrounded by land, federal land, and it is a growing, fast, quickly growing, city. But, there are ways to do this. There was actually a bill introduced by a lawmaker in Nevada that would have drawn a border around Reno and said the federal government can sell this land to developers with this expedited process. But any of that land that gets sold, the funds will go into buying private land elsewhere in the state and making it into public land so that there's no net loss of public land. So there are, other ways to do this. Mike Lee's approach to this has really been to try to throw spaghetti at the wall, see what sticks, see how much he can get privatized. And his drive to privatize public land, it really is kind of cultural. It's not, it's kind of philosophical, I guess I should say. He really just despises public land. He thinks that the federal government shouldn't own land. It comes from an anti-government philosophy and stance rather than like a really practical need to privatize this land.
It's some Republicans, not just Mike Lee, but other Republicans who have been talking about this, they say that the government has mismanaged public lands for decades. But I was having a hard time finding anywhere where it explained what mismanaging means. Do you know what they mean when they say mismanaging land?
Not really. There's one main complaint that's made against federal land managers, and that's the fire suppression policy that's been in place for the majority of our country's existence, which is to put out fires immediately as fast as possible. And that has allowed our forests to sort of become overgrown. It's a pretty complicated, concept, and there's science is split on how we get out of that. But the federal land managers at this point acknowledge that that fire suppression policy was not ideal. And there's pretty broad agreement that like some fire is good fire. But when they say the federal government has mismanaged public lands, oftentimes what they actually mean is the federal government is not putting every acre up for drilling, mining, leasing, logging, because that's what they think good management would be, which is what we're seeing under the Trump administration. That's exactly what they're doing. They are removing rules like the Roadless Rule, passing bills like this Big Beautiful Bill to literally sell off every acre of public land that they can to, well, not sell off, but lease and hand over management to drilling, mining, and logging companies. So that's, they won't come out and say that, but that is what they mean when they say mismanaged. They mean that everything isn't being offered up for extraction.
Now, the roadless rule may have happened at an agency level, but the provision from Senator Lee did get removed from the bill. So it did not pass. It did not happen. And that was largely in part of a bipartisan backlash that he received. Both Republicans and Democrats were against this. Were you surprised at all at, in this polarizing political climate, the bipartisanness of the dislike of Senator Lee's provision?
Yeah, that Amy, that's a great question. I was both surprised and then on further reflection, not surprised. Polling the Colorado College does a poll every year, and they poll Western voters and find that public lands are incredibly popular. And this past year, they actually even asked MAGA identifying, self-identifying voters, and public lands were incredibly popular with that sector of voters. And the majority of those voters actually said that they preferred public lands be conserved rather than developed or drilled on. So, like, we actually knew that based on the data that the majority of voters would oppose this proposal. And in that poll asked about housing as well. And the majority of voters said, no, keep it public land. Don't turn it into housing. Build housing inside of cities where there's already disturbed land. But when I woke up it was a few weeks ago on Monday, and over the weekend, some conservative influencers had started posting about this, and it had just gone viral. And there were people just from across, across the spectrum of the right, all posting about this. People who don't even live in the West were posting about this and saying It's terrible. Don't do it. And at that point, I was pretty shocked. I didn't expect the backlash to be so extreme. And then Mike Lee revised his proposal. And, and a lot of that backlash, I will say, was driven by the fact that he was throwing that spaghetti at the wall and he made over 200 million acres eligible for sale. And, those 200 people, anywhere that people like to hike, their favorite hunting spot, their favorite fishing spot was on that map, essentially. It was just so big. So then he revised his proposal to be smaller and said only BLM lands within 5 miles of cities. And the coalition that had formed said no to that too. And that really shocked me because I thought that maybe they would stomach that, but really we had this rallying cry that really came up from the grassroots. It wasn't, it just naturally came together, and the rallying cry was not 1 acre, and everyone really stood by that across the political spectrum, which was fabulous to see.
Yeah, I was looking at this article I have. I was looking for the hashtag. It was it the not 1 acre hashtag, and also the rather rallying cry was keep public lands in public hands. And
That's
that
right.
yeah.
Public lands in public hands has been one of our rallying cries for years now. The state of Utah tried to co-opt it last year, and the state was trying to get control of public lands by suing the federal government, and they tried to steal that slogan, but I think that we've reclaimed it now, so I'm glad to see that.
Well, that was Kate Gretzinger, Communications Manager for the Center of Western Priorities. Thank you so much for your time today, Kate.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk more about the public and political backlash to this plan to sell off public land. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah added an amendment to sell public lands to the Senate's version of the Big Beautiful Bill. Given past remarks by some Republicans, such as the phrase drill, baby, drill, there was some thought that this idea to sell public land would sneak in within the larger bill unnoticed. That turned out to be far from the case. Americans across the country and across the political aisle rose up to voice their displeasure at the provision. Even some Republicans in Congress made it clear that selling public lands was a red line. They would not vote for the president's bill if the public land sale was in there. Resistance to this plan seemed to be a rare unifying issue in an era of increased partisan politics. Joining me now is Michael Albertus, professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He also wrote the book Land Power: Who Has It, Who Doesn't, and How That Determines the Fate of Societies. Welcome to All Sides, Michael.
Thanks for having me on the program.
So when you heard about this idea from Senator Lee of Utah to sell off public land, what did you immediately think?
Well, to me, recalled to me a proposal that Senator Lee put forth actually a couple years ago in order to try and sell off federal land for housing. But it was a much larger proposal that was put into the Senate bill this time. And for me, immediately, I thought there's no way that this is going to fly with some of these constituencies in the West.
Dan, the majority of the resistance to the sale of this land, it came from the West, but it was actually all over the country. Were you surprised at the unifying voice, both Republican and Democratic side, that came together to resist this land sale?
When you think of it from a broader perspective over the course of the last couple of decades, it is a bit surprising in the sense that there's been convergence between the left and the right on the question of protecting public lands for public purposes. That has shifted, though, from a couple decades ago, and it's certainly not uniformly agreed upon. So there still is a considerable contingent folks who would like to privatize public land or to shift it into the hands of states or local government.
You would expect, Democrats to jump up and raise their hands to protect public land, but there were a lot of conservative groups from very red states that spoke out against this. Some of them being in, Montana, and I think that there were parts of Idaho as well. Do you feel like the conservation of public land can be a unifying issue?
It can be in certain ways. So, what's happened, I think, in recent years, in recent decades, we've seen a greater contingent of folks on the right who would traditionally support, perhaps shifting these into the hands of states or locales, or perhaps privatizing public lands. We've seen them come out in greater and greater support, greater numbers in support of public lands, mainly for the purposes of for recreation. And use for hunting and the like. And public lands are something that are a feature of everyday life in the American West in particular, where the US government owns over half of all land. And people recreate on that land. Like I said, they use it for hunting, they do a lot of different things. And so because of that centrality, there are a lot of groups on the right as well that want to maintain open access to that land.
So, why do you think Senator Lee decided to add this provision into the Trump administration's big important bill, especially if he did not have obvious support for it? And you mentioned he proposed this years ago and didn't have support. So, why do you think Senator Lee has decided that this is so important? I know you don't know him. You didn't ask him. I'm just asking you to speculate, I guess.
Right. Well, like you mentioned, this is a proposal, or this builds on a proposal that Senator Lee put forth a couple of years ago, and so there's clearly a lot of he has been supporting this idea of shifting lands away from the hands of the federal government for years, and I think the idea with the Big Beautiful Bill was that, hey, this is an enormous monster of a bill that has so many different things in it that maybe we can sneak this in as well, and it can get by. But clearly that wasn't the case. The House also tried to sell off or put in a provision to sell off some public lands, a bit over 500,000 acres of public lands in the House version of the bill. That also had to be scrapped because of, in part, Republican opposition to that. A few key Republican legislators opposed that, and the same as what occurred in the case of the Senate version of the bill as well.
And as a political scientist, do you think that his wholehearted support for this could impact the future political career for Senator Lee, since this doesn't seem to have overwhelming broad support in the Republican Party?
Well, while it doesn't have overwhelming broad support in the Republican Party, it still is majority support within the Republican Party. And when you think about a lot of Western contingencies, there are certain, notwithstanding some of the opposition of even conservative groups that want to preserve public lands for the purposes of recreation, there are a lot of groups that would support the notion of transferring land from the hands of the federal government into the hands of states, for example. And Utah actually brought a suit that went to the Supreme Court to try and gain control over a sizable amount of federal land in the state of Utah. And the Supreme Court ended up dismissing that case. But I don't think that this is going to, tank Senator Lee. I think he'll probably continue on the drive, in yet a new iteration at some point in the next year or two to try and, sell off federal land. And he has support in that from Interior Secretary Doug Burgum as well, and parts of the broader Trump administration.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the pushback on the plan to sell public lands with Michael Albertus, a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. I mentioned earlier that you wrote a book called Land Power: Who Has It, Who Doesn't, and How That Determines the Fate of Societies. So, thinking about public land, a lot of this idea to sell it started when Senator Lee was saying that the federal government has too much land and is mismanaging it. Would you agree at all with his statements that the federal government has too much land?
It's sort of a relative, no, I wouldn't agree with that statement. And this, in the sense that, di many different countries have different shares of public and private land. Some countries have very large shares of public land, and there are some countries in which There's no private land. The federal government owns, in formal terms, all land. And so, that mix of public versus private land is determined by a lot of different historical factors. And in the United States, the origins of public lands are essentially in the ways in which the broader United States was built and in which the American West was built, which is through a series of, purchases of enormous amounts of land, or through treaty making or conflict or the like. I'm thinking about the Louisiana Purchase, for example. I'm thinking about, the Oregon Treaty, the Mexican-American War. Those three different, events transferred hundreds of millions of acres of land to the federal government. And at the time, there were no Western states that were formed when that occurred. And so, the government started handing that land out to settlers. It started dispossessing indigenous people from the land, and settlers started producing on the land, felling the forests, and that sort of thing, which generated this conservation movement. And because of that history, the federal government ended up holding on to hundreds of millions of acres of land. And much of this land is fairly remote, fairly rugged, not easy to settle. Population density in the West is relatively low, especially outside of coastal regions. So there's no reason a priori why we should privatize the land or transfer it over to states or anything like that. But it is sort of a dint of historical fate that we are at this particular position.
Yeah, the premise of your book says that that power comes from who owns the land. So why would the federal government want to give that up?
Exactly. The federal government actually, has a lot of, ability to raise revenue through leasing public lands, leasing the rights to access public lands. And so it's not clear why the federal government would necessarily want to get rid of that revenue, aside from ideological reasons, right? If there are politicians that are in power that determine that for, a series of ideological reasons, that it makes more sense to privatize land or to pass it over to the states, then that could theoretically happen. Of course, there's also, the question of private gain. So there are, if the United States federal government was to sell off land, then and it didn't simply pass to states or locales, or if it did and then states and locales also sold it off to private parties, the question is who would buy and at what price? And there could be enormous windfalls for organized interests in that sale of public land. And so that is another component to keep in mind.
Yeah. And another thing that Senator Lee and other Republicans have said is that the federal government mismanages its land. But I couldn't really find anywhere where anyone explains what that means. Do you know what they mean when they say that it's being mismanaged?
I think the idea, I mean, there are various ways, I think there are various reasons that they put forth as to what constitutes or why land is being mismanaged, but it depends on your perspective for what constitutes mismanagement, right? So if you think about the difference between the federal government's interest, let's say, in raising revenue through leasing for purposes of forestry or gas extraction or grazing rights or something like that, locales could say, or states could say, this is not in our local interest, right? The money's not going locally, and we would prefer to use this land for something else. Or perhaps there are, in other cases, the federal government is not using the land and they're conserving parts of the land, whether through various designations, could be wilderness protections or the like. And locales want to use that land or exploit it for the purposes of making revenue. And so, when there's a divergence in what locales or states want and what the federal government want, that's when there's this claim that there's mismanagement. When in fact, what it is really there are different actors at different levels of government that are pursuing different needs.
Is there, or do you think there's any lessons to be learned from this event about how to unify Americans around a certain policy position? Or do you think this is a unique situation? Is public lands a unique situation that can unify Republicans and Democrats?
Well, I do think that there are issues that are like this that can cut across typical, partisan divides. And so when you think about this issue, this same issue actually cuts across divides in a different way that almost flips it on its head. When you think about the housing issue and the housing crisis issue, I think Democrats and Republicans are more and more united on the fact that there needs to be something done to build more housing in the United States because of the housing crisis. And actually, using a small amount of federal land or public land has actually gained Republican and Democratic support as well, at a much smaller scale and a much more targeted fashion. So we saw land transfers, for example, in the Las Vegas area, public land transfers from the Bureau of Land Management to private interests under the Biden-Harris administration, prior to Trump. And that was hailed in many ways as being actually quite successful. It operated at a much smaller scale. And revenue was used to reinvest in conservation initiatives and land preservation elsewhere. But I think when you look at that issue as well from a different angle, we can see something that's rather different that emerges.
And you said public, we're talking about public land being an issue that unites Republicans and Democrats. So housing is another one that unites them in polarizing times. Are there any other ones that you can think of? We only have 30 seconds left.
Sure. I mean, what's kind of funny in these particular times of polarization is that when you ask people a lot of sort of general questions about, support for democracy or independence of the courts or, a pathway to opportunity, people tend to agree in considerable majorities on those. But then when they get filtered through our particular partisan lens that we have on specific issues, then people become far more divided.
That was Michael Albertus, a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jarovich.